Clive Barker is an internationally acclaimed writer, director, artist, and playwright. His latest novel is Days of Magic, Nights of War. It's the second in the planned quartet. Welcome to the show, Clive.
Thanks, Rick.
Clive, let's talk about your beginnings as a writer. The first thing you did really were plays, weren't they?
That's right. And it really was pretty much my ambition that was what I was going to do. I was either going to be a painter or I was going to go into the theater.
Not necessarily the highest paying occupations in
the
world.
Well, that was my mother's point. And one of the changes, one of the key changes in my life was that I got into the Royal College of Art. This would be when I was 18, 1970. And it was a big thing to get into the Royal College of Art. You know, I was really happy to be doing it. It would have taken me away from Liverpool down to London. And my mother said, if it is the last thing that you do for us as your parents, please don't spend this last portion of your education becoming a painter, because it's a waste of time. You'll never make any money from it, blah, 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 et cetera. And being a loving son and she being an Italian mom and therefore quite forcible, I said, okay, you got it. I'll go to university. But I said, I thought this was the catch that would get me out of this. I said, it's now, I think it was then July. And I said, you know, the time for me to be getting into university is way past. The courses begin in September. I think it's too late. And she pulled a special one, got me in to see one of the professors, and he said, yeah, we'll take you in. So out of all perversity, frankly, I studied English literature and philosophy, thinking that philosophy was equally as useless as painting, as a fund creator. And I had an okay time. I didn't have a great time. In a weird way, though, it saved me from something. When I think about what the Royal College of Art was painting in the 70s, I think I would have had a wretched time, because I'm a fantasist. And there was no room for that kind of work in what was going on in the Royal College of Art at that time. There were still the echoes of abstract expressionism, you know, sub Rauschenberg, sub Pollock, sub all of their stuff still playing themselves out in England at that time. And I would have had, you know, I would have been in arguments from one end of the 3 years to the other. So I think in a weird way she saved me. But it meant that I didn't get to pick up an oil paint to paint until I was 44.
Wow. Now, let's go back a little bit further.
Yeah.
What started you reading, writing, and what got you interested in painting in the first place?
I was a very lonely little kid. I was a very insular little kid. I was a very shy little kid. I was a fat little kid. I was a short-sighted little kid. I was born in 52 into a city which had been very heavily bombed in the Second World War and was not a particularly kid-friendly place. There were bombed ruins in a lot of places, which were actually kind of cool places to play. I kind of liked those, but my mom didn't like me playing in those kind of places. I was a terrible sports kid. I was useless at sports. I was your basic issue geek. And so really my thing was, well, what am I good at? And my parents insisted that I joined the Boy Scouts because they thought that would be useful for me. And of course I couldn't put up tents and I couldn't start fires and I, you know, whatever else. But I could tell ghost stories. I could tell really mean ghost stories. And I got this from my grandmother, my paternal grandmother, who was Irish and had the most morbid streak imaginable. I mean, she loved to tell Roy, my younger sibling, and I, the most terrible, terrible, terrible tales, which we, of course, loved. I think, actually, I liked them rather more than Roy did. I think Roy was actually rather freaked by them. But I loved them. And she would pepper her conversation with stories which were perhaps true, perhaps not. There was a fellow called Springheel Jack, who was Liverpool's version of Jack the Ripper, this would be late 19th century, when my grandmother was actually alive in the late 19th century, believe it or not. She lived a long, long time. She lived till she was 96, 97. And she claims to remember on Lime Street, which is one of the major thoroughfares of Liverpool, this fellow with these spring heels that leapt out of the darkness and could leap 20 feet and came down at you with his scalpels gleaming and would cut your throat in an instant. And I loved that stuff. I just loved it.
Well, no wonder.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's great stuff.
Here we are now.
Yeah.
No wonder.
No, thanks, Gran. You know?
And great gift.
She had been visited in her life many times by cancer, and she had half a stomach taken away, one of her lungs, a bunch of other bits and pieces from her interior. And so she drank Guinness, warm Guinness, dark stout. She would put three bottles of Guinness beside the open fire at the beginning of the day. She would then put tripe, tripe in milk with onions on for a slow simmer, and that would be what she would eat throughout the day. Her theory about tripe was that it was easy for her to digest having only half a stomach, because it had been the sheep's stomach anyway, so it was sort of half on its way to being, taken in. And so the house stank of tripe and Guinness, and resounded to her wonderfully throaty, because she smoked, throaty growl, telling tales of Springheel Jack.
Well, no wonder.
Yeah, and here we are.
And here we are. So, when did you start producing plays, and how did you get yourself into this?
Well,
again, not a moneymaker.
No, absolutely not. It was actually the Boy Scouts. I mean, I started writing plays for the Boy Scouts. It was something, again, I could do. And, kids are always looking for ways to legitimize yourself, to feel good amongst your peers. And there weren't an awful lot of things I could do, honestly. And I was terribly shy. But when I wrote, and this is still true, when I write, I feel I take on the personas of the characters I'm writing about, and I feel a great confidence on the page that I don't feel in real life. And it's been a wonderful way for me to connect with life, almost one remove. And I'm the kind of guy who, if I can be persuaded by my husband to go to a party, which is very, very unusual, but if he can persuade me to go to a party, I will be sitting in the corner somewhere, being as inconspicuous as possible, listening in to conversations, because that's the stuff of, the next story. Who knows what's being told? And, of course, L.A. is full of people telling the most outrageous stories about Nip and Tuck and, whatever else.
Let's talk a little bit about how you came to write The Books of Blood.
Okay.
What was their first publication? Were those the Sphere paperbacks?
Yes, they were. I had found myself an agent, a theater agent, who was, and I don't think he would find this description offensive, an elderly queen. And he was a very nice gentleman, but he was an older gentleman and very rather like Quentin Crisp, you know, that sort of figure. And he liked theater. He liked Terence Rattick and a Noel Coward. God knows why he had me on his books. Anyway, we were not having a lot of luck selling my plays. I mean, there were plays called The History of the Devil and Frankenstein in Love. It was no surprise that this man who preferred private lives was not having a great deal of success selling his plays. And so I went to him and I said, Vernon, I have written some short stories. Good, he said, thinking there was going to be a lot of tinkling of martini glasses in my tales. And, of course, I give him three stories, I think. The Midnight Meat Train was one of them.
Oh, yes.
Which kind of speaks for itself. A story called Rawhead Rex, I think, was one. And I really do forget what the third one was. Anyway, he was wonderfully appalled.
Oh, good.
I felt really good about this. He said, these are really, really disgusting and distressing. And I said, that's good then, yes? And he said, well, I don't know anybody who's going to want to publish these. Publishing wasn't his thing. He didn't have any other writers as opposed to playwrights on his books. He was a theater man. But he did know Olivia Gollancz, who was at that time the doyen of Gollancz Publishing, which published a lot of science fiction, a little bit of horror. The tale goes that these stories arrived on Olivia's table, that there was the desk, that there was a silence for a little while, and then a horrified shriek, and the papers were thrown back at her secretary, and I was told to, she was told to deliver them back to the sick little author who'd provided them, never to be heard of again. And so that was rather bad news. And I said to Vernon, you know, maybe we should be going to a paperback house. Maybe you should just be going to somebody who publishes this kind of thing, somebody who wants something a little raw and a little sexy. And this was I published in 1984, so this must be 1982, 1983. I'm about 30. I'm getting a little desperate. I've never had a job, you know?
Right.
And so I'm thinking, this is, I'm going to have to be a teacher if I'm not very careful. And so I found that Sphere Books, which was this really at that time quite small outfit, was publishing a lot of original horror, though no short stories. They were all novels. And so I said, why don't you just try these guys? And a little while later, and this was just one of those lucky things, I later found that they hit the slush pile, these books, these stories, three of them had hit the slush pile. Nobody was really interested in them. They were short stories anyway. And a secretary, a lady called Barbara Boot, who is now one of the eminent editors at Sphere, but was then a secretary, had picked them up and said, you know, these are good. We should think about this. And so they took me out to lunch, and they said, have you got any more of these stories? I said, well, I don't have any written, but I have a lot of ideas. And they said, well, we would publish three books of these at the same time if you could come up with enough ideas. And I said, you know, you picked the right guy. I'm there. And I suppose it was another year, you know, and then or two. And then we published the first three books, and nothing of great significance happened. I mean, they appeared on the shelves. There were no reviews, but they did find their way into the hands of Stephen King. And this is where fate, you know, and luck and circumstance, you know, is just, you just thank God for it. Because Steve said, I've seen the future of horror, and his name is Clive Barker. And that was since turned into something of a monkey on my back. But at that time, it was a really tremendous thing to be said. I mean, this was the man who was selling a million books a week or whatever he was doing. I mean, he had these phenomenal sales.
And still is.
And still is. And was and still is, incredibly respected. And I never met him, and I didn't, don't, to this day, I don't know how the book came into his hands. But it was one of those quotes which just, well, it was the quote which turned my career around.
I remember seeing those books of blood, mm-hmm. the first paperbacks on the shelves in a bookstore in Monrovia.
Okay.
It was a drugstore in Monrovia that, for all its weird drugs, also specialized in having British import horror.
Okay.
And I saw them with the Robert R. McCammon editions, Ball, and all these other things.
Yeah.
And they all just kind of creeped me out a little bit, which I liked.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it was fun because at that time, horror was beginning not to be taken seriously in the sense of reviews. I mean, that came later, not that much later, but it was still a little ways off. But people were starting to read horror in public, let's put it that way, in a way that they hadn't previously. I mean, there had been a long time when horror had been the sort of forgotten man of fiction. And the only other one that had fallen into that category really was spy fiction, and John le Carré's fiction, the Smiley novels, had recently snatched spy fiction out of the doldrums
and into the realms of literature.
Exactly right. And Steve and Pete Straub and Anne Rice and myself, I think, collectively kind of did that for horror over the next few years. And it was very satisfying to be I went on Good Morning America with Steve, and
I remember that appearance.
One of the highlights, I mean, the 3.5 minutes of pure bliss. You know, this is my hero, you know. And Joan London is there, clearly appalled at what she's even... I don't think she read the books. I think she just read the summaries of the stories. She, you know, completely appalled. And I had recently been to a... excuse me. I had recently been to a an autopsy, you know, in the interests of research. And casually mentioned this on the interview. And Joan London made this strangled sound of horror. And I think, in a way, quite unwittingly, I sort of played into being a bit of the bad boy. I mean, I really wasn't the bad boy at all, but I was, you know, the young tyro, the Turk, as it were. At that time, I was 32, something like that. And then I went and made Hellraiser and confirmed everything that everybody had ever thought about me being a twisted, you know, son of a gun.
Let's talk, how did you make Hellraiser? How did you go make the leap from film and playwrights into making what became a major motion picture?
Well, it was never intended to be a major motion picture, I think, is the answer, Rick. I mean, it would cost $900,000. And which would probably buy you, I don't know, you know, a couple of shots in CGI now.
Right.
And I had two movies very quickly made from material from the Books of Blood. Actually, not one from the Books of Blood and one from an original story, both of which I hated. The movies were called, in America, one's called Transmutations, which I believe I truly believe is unwatchable. And the other is the aforementioned Rawhead Rex, which is the...
Close to unwatchable.
Well, I think it's also unwatchable. And I was banned from the sets of both the movies. I mean, I had all the bad experiences. I wasn't paid. You know, it was just a horrible experience. And I thought, darn it, I've directed for the theater. I know a lot of actors. I like actors. I like horror movies. How hard can this be?
Not too hard, apparently.
Not too hard. Well, I mean, I think I was very lucky. What happened was I lucked upon a producer, Chris Figg, who had never produced a movie before, but had been David Lean's sidekick. So he learned at the hands of a really cool director, You know, he knew what he was doing. And Chris was, I think, even a couple of years younger than I was. I was then 33. He was 31. My editor was David Lean's editor. He'd been one of the editors on Lawrence of Arabia, and Dickie Martin is his name, and he was also John Schlesinger's editor. I mean, he, in other words, I was surrounded by these people who knew what they were doing, and I didn't. I mean, I'll be frank. I mean, I knew the story I wanted to tell. I knew how to scare people, but I didn't know anything about lenses or any of that stuff. I was a real novice. And Chris was kind enough and smart enough to say, "Well, I'm going to surround this guy with people who know what they're doing, and hopefully he won't be so pig-headed that he'll ignore their advice." And I didn't ignore their advice. I actually had a very good time shooting the picture, and took a boyhood friend of mine, Doug Bradley, and put him in the part of the guy with the pins in his head. It was a small part in the first movie. We thought nothing of it. It wasn't a particularly large role, though Doug was very good in it. He had a nice round Shakespearean tone to his voice. And there's a long history, as you, I know that of English actors doing very well as both as villains, you know, whether it's Jeremy Irons as Scar in Lion King, or as monsters. I mean, one thinks of Karloff. Mm-hmm. We were the Brits, something about the Brits and our well-rounded vowels, which makes us sound instantly, I guess, to the American ear more vicious and cold
and sinister
exactly than anybody else. So he is Doug. He was 3 years my junior, so he was 28 when he first did the first Hellraiser movie. And I had done the designs, drawn the designs a long time before, and I gave them to the makeup guy. The makeup guys had done Aliens, so they knew what they were talking about.
Boy, that was good.
Oh yeah, no, I was really protected, Rick. I mean, I really was. And I tell you, Helen Keller could have made a good movie with these people around, you know. And so I had a blast doing it, and had no expectation then of the movie at all. I mean, there was talk of it going straight to video, which was a big deal at that time. Video was just coming up. A lot of horror movies going to video. I didn't have much problem with that. I didn't know America very well. I'd been over here a few times doing a couple of minor book tours, but I was not at all familiar with... Well, I don't think any of us were that familiar with, actually, thinking back, with the idea of being number one over the weekend, you know. Mm-hmm. That's a very recent phenomenon, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's the past few years it's really come out.
Suddenly we were obsessed with how much money the movie made and so on. Well, back then, I don't think any of us knew, and I certainly didn't know. So I came over here, did a couple of interviews, not a lot, and showed the movie, got some pretty darn ugly reviews, and then the movie was a number one movie for its week, and I got this excited telephone call on Monday, "You're the number one movie, you know," and I was, "Oh yeah, cool, yeah, cool, yeah." I mean, what did I know? And you know, it did mean something, as it turned out. I mean, it meant that they made another 8 of them.
There's 8 now?
I think there's 8. I haven't seen the last 3, so I don't know.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah. It might be only 7. I'm not, you know, Rick, I'm not sure. There's a bunch more.
Both in print and in film, you pioneered a level of violence and gore that really hadn't been seen on the page or on the screen. What drove you to do that?
I think Well, my first answer was going to be a joke, and I have to go with my first answer. It's fun, and part of me thinks
that's a perfect
true.
That's,
you know,
that's not a joke. That's true.
It's true. I think that I was aware that as an audience member, and I've been seeing these horror movies. I've been seeing these horror movies since I was 18, remembering that. You know, we were a lot fiercer about not letting young people into movies in England until we were 18. So though I did creep in with a friend of mine called Norman, believe it or not, to see Psycho when I was 16, on a double bill with George Powell's War of the Worlds. And that was very exciting to me to see something that was as scary as... Actually, I found both movies scary.
Oh, yes.
And so I enjoyed being scared, but I feel still, that really at the heart of what makes an experience, a movie experience, horror movie experience powerful, is the sense that you're going to... deal with issues which are body related. They're to do with what the body looks like on the inside, looks like in the places where we're not supposed to look. And I think one of the reasons for that is because we're, well, let me give you an example. There's a very small scene in the first Hellraiser movie in which some characters are moving a mattress up a stairs, and there's a nail sticking out of one of the posts on the banisters, and you can see this coming, that this guy's hand is going to get gouged by this nail. Not a big gag. I mean, it was not a hugely sophisticated piece of special effects or anything, but I watched that scene with an audience, and everybody just covered their faces, because we've all done things like that, you know. Very often, the more baroque and more extensive, the grander the guignol, the less the audience has a response, curiously. You know, by the time you get to the end of Hellraiser, and there's blood all over everything, you know, it's like the last act of Hamlet. And nobody, I think, is as upset as they were seeing that single nail do its job. But I do believe that part of my job as a Frightmeister, if you will, is to keep upping the ante. You know, you start with some small things, and then it gets grander, and then it gets really grand. And I think one of the things that's happened, unfortunately, and perhaps we'll talk about this later, but in recent horror movies, is that CGI has allowed us to get very grand. I mean, CGI has allowed us to show everything. And everything isn't necessarily what we want to see. Curiously, that we have to be kind of clever about what we show. It's not the point. The point is not to show an autopsy, but to just show enough to make the audience go, "Oh, please stop that." And it's a test. A horror movie is a test. It's one of the reasons, an initiation, I think. I was on a chat show run by Dr. Ruth with Wes Craven, and Dr. Ruth says, So, Mr. Barker, you make these horror movies. Why is it I'm doing a terrible accent. Why is it the little boys and little girls, they all want to make love while they're watching horror movies? And it's true. There is a huge amount of making out in horror movies. And I think it's because it's a perfect time. You know, you're watching a horror movie. The girl squeezes a little closer to the boy. The boy squeezes a little closer to the girl. Or in these times, the boy and the boy, or the girl and the girl. And and it's a kind of, I can't stand this, says the girl, covering her eyes, and the boy says, yes, well, I can, and he keeps looking. It becomes one of those initiations, and it's been a very interesting thing learning, because there's been a lot of writing about this recently. I mean, in the last 20 years, there's been a lot of theorizing, mainly by the French philosophers, Julia Kristeva, for instance, has written very interestingly about why we look at this material and why particularly young people look at this material. At the age of 51, I find horror movies much harder to look at than I did at the age of 31. You know, I've watched more people die.
Sure. Now, while we're talking about movies, you've said movies are dumb, and they're getting dumber.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I hold to that.
I wouldn't disagree, but you yourself are a movie maker.
Yeah.
Do you intend to return to film? It's been a while since we've seen a Clive Barker movie. Do you intend to return to film as a director and a writer?
I have a script at Universal right now. And really, it comes down to this, Rick. I will do it if I can do it my way. But honestly, if I can't do it my way, what's the use of doing it? It's the great thing about doing books is, and particularly the case with the ABRAP books, where I'm actually providing paintings as well. It's my vision. Nobody's messing with it. And the trouble with movies is, as soon as they smell a dollar, let me give you an example. I didn't see anybody from the funding company, the guys who were providing the $900,000 for Hellraiser, for most of the shooting, the 9 weeks of shooting or 10 weeks of shooting, until they began to get the feeling that maybe the movie was working, and then suddenly I had a visitation from the Suits. And I was taken out to dinner, and this was all new to me. I thought they were just going to tell you what a fine chap I was. But no, they had ulterior motives. They wanted me to start doing it their way. And one of the first thing they said was, is the guy with the pins in his face cannot talk, cannot say a word. And I said, why? He said, well, they said, there's actually a guy called Bob Ramey, he said, who went on to do a lot of other things. But Bob said to me, Michael Myers from the Halloween doesn't speak. Jason Voorhees from the Friday the 13th pictures doesn't speak. Freddy Krueger says a few one-liners, but he pretty much keeps himself to himself. Your guy cannot speak. And besides which, he speaks English. I mean, it's those well-turned English phrases. I mean, it's just not scary. And I said, well, you know what? And I didn't have much to lose, to be perfectly honest. I mean, they were paying me $21,000 to write and direct this picture. I said, you know, what if you want to do that, you do it, but you can do it without me. I mean, it was pretty straightforward. I want to do it my way, and if you don't want to do it my way, then that's cool. I'll just let you do it. And, of course, they immediately backed off and said, okay, do it your way, do it your way. And we never tested the movie. Too small a movie to test, which was a blessed thing.
Absolutely.
You know, I actually said that I had a conversation with Bill Friedkin once, and Bill said to me, if he'd tested The Exorcist, he said, we would never have seen the movie that became, you know, such a huge, phenomenal movie around the world, because the testees would have critiqued the masturbation with the crucifix scene and the vomit scene, and you can't have the head turning all the way around because her neck would be broken, and how's that even logical, and you know, all that kind of stuff, and his movie would have been cut to pieces by a committee. But again, his movie was too small, and he was a little too powerful, because he'd won a bunch of Oscars the previous year for...
Alice doesn't live in here?
French Connection.
French Connection?
I think. And he did he got his movie out the way he wanted it. I got my movie out pretty much the way I wanted it. They revoiced some of the characters because they weren't American. But pretty much it was my movie. I mean, I lost a few seconds here and there to the MPAA, but there wasn't a lot. And this will amuse you. We had a scene and upstairs in the attic of this old house where this damned figure Frank has been brought back from the dead by the shedding of his brother's blood, and he is obviously subject to attacks by rats because he's not entirely himself right now. He's lacking a skin, you know, and I think rats probably go after you if you're lacking a skin. And there's a short scene in which we see a bunch of rats have been nailed to the wall and they're twitching. Well, I am a very serious animal activist. I would never do anything, not a fly, not a maggot. Nothing's going to get harmed in a movie for me. So these needed to be mechanical rats. Well, the BBFC, the British Board of Film Classification, as it was, which is the English form of the MPAA, said, these are real rats. And I said, honestly, they're not real rats, they're mechanical rats. And they said, no, they're real rats, you have to cut them from the movie. Because you've abused real rats. And I said, I have not abused real rats, and I will bring in the mechanical rats to prove it. So next day, I brought in the mechanical rats, made them twitch sufficiently to satisfy the BBFC, and the scene stayed in the movie. I mean, those sorts of things are so weird. The BBFC the MPA at that time, I had done a sex scene which was really fairly raunchy for its time, had a little bit of spanking going on in it, and then some fairly serious sex stuff. And I was sending, after this big meeting, when they'd all come over and see me, they wanted the dailies sent over, because I was shooting in England, to LA every day so that they could see what I was shooting. They were watching me more closely.
Boy.
Yeah. And so I sent these sex scenes over, which I was rather proud of. I mean, the closed set, I'd really got some pretty amazing stuff out of the actress and the actor. Very brave, did some pretty outrageous stuff. And I got this call from Bob Ramey, and he said, yeah, that's amazing. It's amazing. The sex stuff is amazing. We can't use any of it. And I said, what's the deal, Bob? He said, you can't do that. I'm not going to put that in the movie. I mean, the MPAA won't allow it. And I said, look, if you want me to reshoot this, tell me what the rules are, and then I'll reshoot it. But I'm not going to reshoot it in a vacuum, you know? And this was one of the instructions, Rick, and I swear I wish I had it still. I probably do have it still somewhere. That I was allowed 2 consecutive thrusts of the buttocks. But the third thrust would be deemed obscene. So during the love scene, I was allowed 1 thrust, 2 thrusts. Then I needed to cut away to daffodils or, you know, a scene with horses. And then Or to rats on the wall. And then back for 3rd and 4th thrust. And I think it was that which began a lifelong, really a lifelong contempt for the way that we are sort of manipulated by these people, because the MPAA are really making it up as they go along. And, it's always amazed me, for instance, that there is such horror about sex in American movies, and such indifference to violence. When you think the act which has brought us all into being is actually something you cannot see represented, otherwise it's an NC-17. On the other hand, you can go and see, I went to see a Resident Evil last night, which is a movie, you know, it's a 90 minutes of violence from, you know, with very little dialogue to interrupt the gunfire. you know, there were kids sitting in there.
Sure.
You know, having a fine old time.
Well, it's amazing to me the level of violence and gore that you can see just on unrated right there television.
You're right.
Today.
You're right.
It's the kind of thing that I think in back when Hellraiser came out,
oh, yeah,
would have been an NC-17 movie. And
yeah.
I'm curious what you think about that.
Well, I think we've changed. I mean, the culture's changed. I mean, going back to 1960 when Psycho was made, was released, it was condemned roundly, as you know, by almost every American reviewer as marking a new low in cinematic depravity. This was just the worst that cinema could get. It could not get any cruder or viler than this movie. Now, of course, it's an American classic, and we look at the movie and we think, well, what was the problem? We forget that that was the first time that a toilet, an operating toilet, had ever been shown in an American movie. You know, she throws the, remember, she tears up the letter, she throws the pieces into the toilet, and then she flushes them away. First time it's ever been seen. And there were forces in the MPA who thought that Hitchcock shouldn't show that, that was just not, that was indecent. And now we... And I'm not saying this is a good thing. I'm just saying this is the way the world is. That if you go to the 6 o'clock news now, and I, you know, now we're moving to very serious subject very suddenly. You know, you see stuff from Iraq, which is heartbreakingly violent, and One of the distinctions that I've always made is that horror should always have an element of the supernatural. That's been part of my game plan, that really you could always unplug from the reality of it because there was always something demonic or magical or whatever going on.
Why you deal with that way.
Yeah, you could deal. You could say, well, this isn't going to happen at home. I've never made a movie about a psycho killer or anything like that. I'm not saying that anything about those kinds of movies. I've enjoyed a number of them. Silence of the Lambs, an amazing movie, but it's just not the cup of tea for me. I've always felt that as long as I had this sort of supernatural element in it, I could help unplug the audience from this being a little too much for them, because they always had the this couldn't happen to me element. You know, it's what Spielberg did in Poltergeist, you know, so effectively. I mean, you know, I think Poltergeist is a fine picture, and it's one of the fun things about it is that, you know, you don't think for a moment it's going to happen in your house. And so I have seen, we have all seen in the last 30 years since I made Hellraiser, you know, 30 years, can't be 30 years since I made Hellraiser. 20 years, yes, thank you, gosh. 20 years since I made Hellraiser. We've seen what we can look at on television, or what we can see as we open a magazine, intensified hundredfold. And
part of that is what we've seen on the news too.
That's really what I'm talking about. I'm not really talking about the news. I mean, I think it started in America with film from Vietnam, if I'm right.
Exactly, that's what I was thinking. Some of the scenes where people, the street executions, the monk who set himself on fire.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are the kind of things that...
But, you know, I mean, good God, they're watching. I mean, I'm not watching because it's something I can't face. This is very interesting how this is the distinction in my head. Nothing could make me watch one of those beheadings on video. You know, the beheadings of these poor
captives.
Right,
there was one reported, I believe, today.
Nothing could make me do that. Now I just get sick. I mean, I'm sort of, a bit squeamish about that stuff. And I suppose a part of me thinks it's immoral to take any kind of satisfaction from watching something like that. Whereas, if there's a supernatural element or if it's a fantasy element, I don't feel so problematic about it. Maybe I'm kidding myself, but it's how I come to terms with the kind of work that I actually, as a viewer, really enjoy. I love to be scared.
Let's talk a little bit about sex and sexuality in your work.
Ooh, let's.
Beyond the gore factor, I think what really upset people when your work first became noticed was the amount of sex, the variety of sex.
That. The size of the menu.
The size of the menu was a bit larger than other menus we'd seen years before. What draws you to that? You've professed an interest in pornography.
Sure. I think, it's a $6 billion a year business in this country. Well, I'm not spending that much on magazines, so somebody else must be buying, I think we're very hypocritical about this, and I think it was quite interesting to me. I've lived here for 12, 13 years now, and I am about to become a citizen. And so I love America, I really do. It's in my blood and my heart now, and I'm very happy to be ready to vote and become a part of the culture in that way, as well as the way I've attempted so far. But I also think there is a deeply puritanical streak in American culture, which isn't in a lot of European culture. And I say a lot of European culture because I think it is in British culture, but I don't think it's in French culture or Spanish culture. An example, the whole Monica Lewinsky thing. I was in Europe during that time, and there were a lot of European really people who loved this country, who found it very hard to defend, and I was amongst them, the moral complexity of our response to wanting to know about the dress, but at the same time condemning her for having the dress and condemning him for doing the thing with the cigar, at the same time wanting to know what he'd actually done with the cigar. In other words, we want our, I was about to say cake and eat it, which is, I don't know what that's going to do for our metaphorical life, but I think we live in a very complicated world, in other words, where sex is concerned, and I wanted that to be a part of what I was writing. And horror fiction has always had sexual subtext, Dracula. Vampires are, as Anne Rice has proved over and over again, are immensely sexual. There are power games, which are arguably sexual power games, being played out every time a monster picks up a beautiful, bikini clad, or like the girl picked up by the monster from the Black Lagoon, I mean, that famous still of the Beauty and the Beast. That has a sexual energy in it. And I wanted, in a way, to sort of call the bluff of that and say, well, enough of this as subtext. Let's just deal with it as text and see how it works. And one of the things that I found interesting about being able to do that was that you could still make the stories very scary. It wasn't as though just half mentioning this stuff was really what was feeding the scare. It wasn't as though a subtle handling of the sexual stuff was really what was making the stuff scary. I could be quite blatant about the sexuality, and as you said, a fair range of kinds of sexuality. There were gay characters, there were, you know, there was even a love affair between a girl and a gorilla in one of the stories. Which ended happily.
Is that the new Murders in the Rue Morgue?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. And even a marriage, you know? It's a happy ending for everybody. But my point was that in a form of fiction in which you are writing about the body and you're writing about the way that the mind influences the body and the way we are shaped by our desires, how could you not mention sex? How could sex not be a part of that kind of fiction? It seemed hypocritical to me.